Yeah, thank you very much, Cheryl. And I'm going to begin by just continuing with a comment that you made on the mic. Since I'm recording this, I'll just do a little preamble for those listening to the recording. Today was Jacqueline's second day of teaching from the book Wake Up and Roar about Papaji, and she teaches the hour just before me, so I've committed to coming and listening to her. And, you know, Cheryl made a comment that when Jacqueline is teaching from that book, she's actually demonstrating contemplation. And Cheryl said, you know, that was really helpful for her. And I made the comment in writing that Jacqueline's style of teaching is perfect. And the reason I'm saying this now is because I know that other people who teach are listening to me, and others will be listening to the recording. And so what I want to say is, you know, this is how we wake ourselves up. Or this is how we stretch, grow, and realize. Well, there's two things that I notice that sometimes people do that are mistakes. One is they'll come in with the book, and they primarily just read from the book, right? Maybe they make a comment, a small comment every now and then, but they primarily just read from the book. And the impression that at least I get is that they think the book knows something, and they don't. So they read from the expert, the book. And, you know, the books can be very good and very interesting to listen to, but that doesn't really do a lot for the one reading. And our real reason for teaching here, our real reason for teaching here is to wake ourselves up. So we have to participate in our own teaching. The other mistake that people sometimes make is and I don't see this as often, to be honest, is they think they need to be the expert. You know, I can only teach something I already know. And so they come in and they're teaching others what they already know. And again, there's no stretching, no growth, no additional realizing happening there. And in fact, I have unfortunately seen, not here in the sanctuary, but just out there in general, I have seen teachers that use this style of teaching over and over and over again. And I've known them for years. And I can actually see that they aren't growing or stretching or realizing, because they're staying in that safe zone with what they already know. So, again, our purpose for teaching here is to wake ourselves up. So the best thing to do, you don't want to take a book that's so far above your head that, you know, like, I have no idea what this guy's saying. And for all of us, at some point along the journey, there is a book that's so far above our head, it's like, oh my God, you know, I have no idea what this guy's saying. But we do want to take a book that's a stretch for us. Like, you know, we have to pause and contemplate. And, you know, and like Jacqueline said with this last thing, I'm not sure what that means. I'll contemplate that and come back next week. Or sometimes we even make a mistake in our teaching. And then as we teach a little further, go, oh, I realize what I said a while ago was wrong. Let me go back. Now I see what he's talking about. And, you know, that's all perfect, because that's waking ourselves up. And I love how when Jacqueline was teaching, how, you know, she would be reading a sentence and something would strike her mind. It might not even be exactly what Papaji is talking about at that point, but it strikes her mind and then she stops and goes into it. You know, that whole delivery that she did in the last hour about the many facades of selves that we carry around within ourselves, the many false images that we carry within ourselves. That was a beautiful teaching. And although Papaji did get to that point, he wasn't there yet. You know, so it's not like she was really saying, here's what Papaji is saying, because you know what? He actually wasn't saying that yet. But it struck her mind. You know, that was the inspiration that struck her mind. And so she went in and talked about it. That's how we do this. That's how we do this. That's a perfect model for teaching. So for those of you who are here and heard that model, I think it's great that Cheryl recognized it. Cheryl, it really is out loud contemplation. That's what the best teaching is. And again, when I say teaching, the one we're teaching is ourself. So the best teaching is an out loud contemplation. You don't know everything. Sometimes you make mistakes. Sometimes you have to go and contemplate it for a week and come back and comment on it. Perfect. Perfect. So thank you. Okay, 1 second. This is just a text from my housekeeper, but she's trying to set her schedule, so let me just answer her. Although I don't really love 9 a.m., I'm going to go ahead and tell her yes, and then I'll talk to her about it later. Because that's, you know, that could be right in the middle of my meditation. We'll see. All right, I'll talk to her about it. She did that a couple weeks ago, too, so I don't know. Or maybe I just change the way I do things in the morning. We'll see how that goes. Yeah, and Cheryl has said she noticed that it's a stretch reading out loud and contemplating. Absolutely. Yeah, and that's what we want to do. That's perfect, 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 perfect. So I'm going to demonstrate that myself. Because that's what I do with the spiritual teaching of Ramana Maharshi and with I Am That, you know. But before I put myself in the hot seat, I am going to play a song. This, for me, is a blast from the past. Some of you may have never heard it before. Once upon a time, I used to listen constantly to songs by Resta Burnham. And so this is a Resta Burnham song. And really what inspired me to play this was Jacqueline's teaching also when Papaji was talking about, you know, just be still. Be present right now. So the name of the song by Resta is Be Still.
Be still, my child, be still at peace. Within my silence, be filled with me. My holy child, I love you so well. Be still, be still, be still. In this moment, in this now, we are forever one. Leave behind you tomorrow's and yesterday's, and enter now, my love. Be still, my child, be still at peace. Within my silence, be filled. Holy child, I love you so well. Be still, be still, be still. Lay down your burdens, release your cares. Come as a child to my arms. Here in the stillness, light will fill your mind. Still. still. My holy child, I love you so well. Be still, be still, be still.
Yeah, it was really nice to hear that song again. That's a lovely song. So, we are here now for the guiding light, and I am sharing from the spiritual teaching of Ramana Maharshi, and I am on page 27, and today I am starting with question 22 at the bottom of the page, and here we go. Is asceticism one of the essential requisites for a person to become established in the self? It's a good thing I don't have the strong unworthy gene, because my dog just moaned like, oh my gosh, she's going to teach again, and rolled over. So asceticism. Asceticism isn't something that we traditionally think about a lot in the West, although as, you know, on our particular spiritual bend, since we do have a connection to the Eastern teachings, some Westerners in our spiritual bend will think about asceticism. But most Westerners really don't. This is more an Eastern idea that you need to give up your family, really give up all but the bare minimum of food, bare minimum of clothing, bare minimum of possessions. In order to awaken. In fact, if you read about Indian saints, you know, you'll often read about how little they had. Like if you read about Ram Dass, not Richard Alpert, but the one that he named himself after, Ram Dass, an Indian saint. You know, you'll read things like he had nothing but his loincloth and a bowl. And in fact, even in our culture, there's someone that we know that was a bit of an aesthetic that we tend to love, and that's Peace Pilgrim, right? She had a comb. I think maybe she had stamps, paper, a pen, and a toothbrush, and the clothes on her back, right? And so sometimes people get this idea that, you know, this type of minimalism is a requirement, and if we are not giving up everything, family, possessions, and again, even food. Remember, Peace Pilgrim walked until offered shelter, fasted until offered food. And she says the longest she ever had to go without, she says it as if it wasn't very long. You know, the longest I ever had to go without food was only 3 days. You know, but again, people get this idea like, oh my God, you know, that's what I have to do. And so that's really what this question is coming from. You know, so the question again is asceticism one of the essential requisites for a person to become established in the self? All right, here's the answer. The effort that is made to get rid of attachment to one's body is really toward abiding in the self. Maturity of thought and inquiry alone removes attachment to the body, not the stations of life, such as students, etc. For the attachment is in the mind, while the stations pertain to the body. How can bodily stations remove the attachment in the mind? As maturity of thought and inquiry pertain to the mind, these alone can, by inquiry on the part of the same mind, remove the attachments which have crept into it through thoughtlessness. It's a little long, but I'm going to keep reading, then we'll go back and break it up. But as the discipline of asceticism is the means for attaining dispassion, and as dispassion is the means for inquiry, joining an order of ascetics may be regarded in a way as a means of inquiry through dispassion. Instead of wasting one's life by entering the order of ascetics before one is fit for it, it is better to live a householder's life. In order to fix the mind in the self, which is its true nature, it is necessary to separate it from the family of fancies and doubts. That is, to renounce the family in the mind. This is real asceticism. All right, so we'll go back and look at this answer a little more slowly. So he starts off by saying the effort that is made to get rid of attachment to one's body is really toward abiding in the self. So when he's answering this first, when he's answering this question, this first sentence is referring to why do people become ascetics in the first place? You know, why do people go to where they only have a loincloth and a bowl and they sleep on a dusty floor, a cold, dusty, you know, floor in a shack or in a cave, and they only have food when it's offered to them? Why do they do this is really what he's responding to first. And he's saying that the reason people are doing this is because they're trying to get rid of the attachment to the body. And in fact, if you know anything about the story of Buddha, this is how Buddha started off too, right? This extreme asceticism. And we do need to get rid of, I don't know if I like those words, I'm going to say transcend. I think I like the word transcend better. We do need to transcend the attachment to the body. That is something that we need to do. So this is where the history in the East of asceticism comes from, because there's this knowledge, this intuitive knowledge, that we need to transcend the belief that I am the body. And then that knowledge gets followed up by a thought that I can transcend the body by giving up all of this stuff that pampers the body. But if you know anything about Buddha, you know that one of Buddha's first great realizations was that's not true. That's not true at all. You know, I don't transcend the body by such extreme denial. In fact, when I go through such extreme denial, I create additional problems for myself. You know, when the body is starving and weak, and the brain is not properly nourished, I'm not able to focus on meditation and inquiry as well. You know, if I take reasonable care of the body, then I'm able to focus on inquiry better. So Buddha was like, hey, you guys, you know, come bathe, come eat. And those that had been following him as an ascetic, they left him. They thought he had quit the path. But actually, what he did was he realized that that isn't the way to deny the body, the way to transcend the body. The way that you transcend the body is through the inner inquiry or the inner meditation. And some strength of body is actually helpful toward that end. You know, I have in my office many, many symbols. I just love them. And one of the symbols is a cow. Nandi, she's called, N-A-N-D-I, Nandi. And Nandi is actually Shiva, you know, the god Shiva. Nandi is called Shiva's vehicle. And I don't really know any more than that. There's the extent of my knowledge about Nandi and Shiva. So everything else has to do with symbology in Regina's mind. It has nothing to do with accurate Hindu religious teachings. But what Nandi reminds me of when I look at her in my office is she reminds me that the body is just a vehicle, right? Shiva the god had a vehicle, Nandi. And what consciousness has in this world through each of us apparent humans is a vehicle. And those vehicles are our bodies. Now, I also have in my garage another vehicle, a Toyota 4Runner. And my Toyota 4Runner, every 5,000 miles, this little light comes on that says, maintenance needed. And so when that little light comes on that says maintenance needed, I make an appointment and I take it down to the Toyota place and they rotate the tires and change the oil and maybe change some filters or do something else. But they're keeping that vehicle in good shape so that it can be used. Well, why would the body be any different? If the body is a vehicle, right, doesn't it need to be taken care of as well as my Toyota 4Runner, another vehicle? So that's what Nandi represents to me. Nandi is not Shiva, right? Shiva the god. Nandi is not Shiva. Nandi is Shiva's vehicle. This body is not what I am, but it is the vehicle that I have in this world. Not only is it the vehicle for anything that I may do, but it is also the vehicle for awakening. And to keep the body taken care of so that I feel as strong as possible, so that the brain is working as well as possible, all of this is helpful towards inquiry. In fact, I read a quote once, I think it might have been Annamalai Swami, who was a devotee of Ramana Maharshi. And he said something like, I can't quote exactly, but the idea was that that awakening or enlightenment is when the ego dies before the body dies. Therefore, take care of the body until the ego dies. Right? You don't want the body dying first. If enlightenment is the ego dying before the body dies, well, then keep that body, you know, as good a shape as you can so that it will live and be your vehicle until the ego dies. Right? And to me, that makes perfect sense. So, again, Ramana Maharshi is really pointing out that the reason the East has a tradition of asceticism at all is because people have this kind of misperception that by this physical denying the body of what it needs, by this physical denying the body of shelter and clothing and food, that somehow they're going to transcend the body. But again, Buddha discovered that was a mistake, right? Buddha learned to take care of the body. It's called the middle way. It's not embracing the body as me, but it's not ignoring the body as my vehicle either. It's the middle way. It's not me. It's my Nandi. Right, it's my vehicle. So under the question, is asceticism one of the essential requisites for a person to become established in the self? The first sentence, the effort that is made to get rid of attachment to one's body is really toward abiding the self. You know, that's what they want. They want to find the self and abide in it. And then his second sentence, maturity of thought and inquiry alone removes attachment to the body. Maturity of thought and inquiry alone removes attachment to the body. So in that sentence right there, he is denying that asceticism is at all necessary. And what's really interesting about this, well, you have to listen to this teaching with the right mind and not the judging mind, because Ramana Maharshi himself was an ascetic. He left home when he was around 17 years old. He stole the money. For those of you who don't know the story, he stole the money from his brother. His brother had left the money for Ramana to take and pay the brother's school tuition. So it was his older brother. He left a note for his little brother, take this money and go pay my tuition. And when Ramana saw the note, he's like, ooh, money. And he stole the money and left a note saying that he was leaving and that the tuition had not been paid. Well, there's something the judging mind can get a hold of. So he takes this money that he stole, and I think if I remember correctly, he bought a train fare in order to try and get himself to Tiruvannamalai, and I don't remember all the details. Like, we can look it up and read it. That might be kind of fun. But anyway, he eventually gets to the point where he is there, and there's still some money left over. And you know what he does with that leftover money? He throws it into the water. And he never has anything to do with money again. You know, I told you that Ram Dass only had his loincloth and a bowl. Ramana Maharshi didn't even have a bowl. So it's interesting to, you know, imagine yourself as a devotee in front of this great ascetic, asking if asceticism is necessary, and in effect, his answer is no. Right? So you can't really think about these things, because then the mind might start asking, well, then why did you do it? You know? the answer would be that was just that body's way, you know, that body's karma, right? But it's not necessary. We don't all have to have the same karma in order to reach the same awakening. In fact, there's another story about Ramana Maharshi. For Anne and Jacqueline, you were with me. We went to India last year, and you'll remember we went to the temple, the Shiva temple one day, and we went down underneath. We weren't allowed to stay there. It was kind of like a walk-through tour. But we went down underneath into the little place underneath the temple where Ramana sat and meditated. And Ramana sat down there to the point that bugs were literally eating his body, eating his skin. And he did not emerge from meditation at all. He stayed in meditation and just let the bugs eat his body. And some people say, you know, Ramana started having poor health at around age 40. And some people say the reason he started having poor health at such a young age was because of his many years of asceticism and not taking care of the body during that time, which is a distinct possibility. And so again, someone will say, but you did it. You know, how come I don't have to do it? And the answer is, it's not everybody's karma. That's not what's necessary. You know, that's not what's necessary. What's necessary is to transcend the belief that you are the body. You don't necessarily need to sit in a cave and let bugs eat your body. Right? That was his way, but it doesn't have to be our way. And in fact, if you know Ramana Maharshi's teachings well, he never recommended that for anyone. But what he did recommend is what I'm sure was actually going on when he was sitting in that cave so engrossed in meditation. Was the deep, deep, deep inquiry. And in his case, the abiding in the self until there was nothing left but the self, right? All the way from the... Now, this is my guess. I don't know this for a fact, so I want to say that clearly. But, you know, Ramana Maharshi is credited with having an awakening at age 17, or maybe 16. It was right around his birthday. I don't remember if it was right before or right after. So he was either 16 or 17, depending on when his birthday was and when this happened. But my guess is that that awakening was the awakening to unity consciousness. He became aware of the self, because from unity consciousness you are then aware of the self. And then he had such a strong attraction to be completely absorbed into that. In other words, to go all the way beyond consciousness to truth. That he then spent the next umpteen years, I never remember the number exactly, but the next umpteen years totally focused on that self. And letting everything else burn up, letting everything else burn up, letting everything else burn up until there was nothing, nothing left. So although a lot of people say, you know, he woke up at age 16 or 17, I think, and again, I don't know this for a fact, I think he saw that awakening as a beginning. And that's why the next period of his life was focused on such concentrated meditation. He went with that beginning until there was a total ending, which is full awakening, awakening beyond consciousness. So what he's talking about here, that inquiry alone removes attachment to the body, that was one of his primary teachings. And my guess is that was his primary path. That, you know, that is what he was doing. And again, inquiry doesn't necessarily mean asking the seeking question, what am I? Although that's where most of us begin. The true definition of the word inquiry is focusing on the self. You know, the seeking question, what am I or who am I, merely directs the attention to the self so that you can focus on it. But the real actual inquiry is the uninterrupted focus on the self. And that's what I feel Ramana Maharshi was doing during that long phase of his life where he sat in caves and meditated. So again, he says, maturity of thought and inquiry alone removes attachment to the body. Now, I'm not real clear on what he means by maturity of thought. My guess would be that he really means right-minded thinking versus wrong-minded thinking. So wrong-minded thinking is the self-centered thinking, right? Worrying about me, me, me. And of course, the extension, my family, my friends, my country, right? But all of that self-centered thinking would be immature thought. Maturity of thought is the right mind thinking, you know, with what I call spiritual wisdom, that right-minded thinking. So right-minded thinking and inquiry alone remove attachment to the body. So we do need to transcend our me, me, me thinking, our self-centered thinking. You know, seeing the entire world and all events from my point of view. That's important. Not necessarily giving up the house, giving up the family, giving up the clothes, but learning to be with those things without constantly having that self-centered thinking going on in the mind. And, you know, I've had the thought myself, and I wouldn't be surprised if some of you at some time have this thought too, that it would be a lot easier if I was, you know, not in a cave. I'm not that crazy. I know that a cave would distract me, but, you know, in a little house in La Vida, where I had access to a shower and food and shelter, but there was nobody around. You know, I could be all by myself in my more modern, more comfortable cave, but a sort of Western asceticism. And that this awakening process would be a lot easier. But I think that there is probably great value in the challenge of giving up self-centered thinking right here in our everyday lives. And in fact, later in this particular answer, Ramana Maharshi actually says, instead of wasting one's life by entering the order of ascetics before one is fit for it, it is better to live a householder's life. It's better to just stay right where you're at and practice right there. Don't change a thing. And I suppose if a calling, a true calling comes to go off in the woods, you know, two teachers that I've recently read, Bernadette Roberts and the one I'm reading now, Floyd Henderson, both of which did go off in the woods for a period of weeks, you know, like half a year, 6 months or something like that. And maybe at some point that calling really does come. And you find yourself going off for 6 months in kind of an aesthetic sort of way. But the point is, that would be such a deep, deep calling that you wouldn't be able to stop yourself. You'd be like, I have to go do this now. It's not the same as the mental idea. You know, oh, you know, Ramana was an aesthetic and, you know, Bernadette Roberts went off to the woods and Floyd Henderson went off to the woods and whatever else. And, oh, I better go off to the woods. You know, that's not it. Better to stay right where you are. Learn to let go of self-centered thinking. Think with spiritual intuition. Think with mature thought. And practice inquiry. Don't go changing anything. You know, chasing a better situation is actually still just listening to ego. It would be better if this were different, right? That's ego's mantra. It would be better if this were different. I've always told people that my default is what is. And what I mean by that is, you know, when change started happening for me, physical change as a part of my spiritual path, I was living in Acton, Massachusetts, and I had a job at private healthcare systems. And at first I was thinking, I need to escape this. I need to get out of this situation in order to awaken. But at one point, a song came into my mind. And the song was, if I can make it here, I can make it anywhere. The name of the song is New York, New York, but only those two lines came into my mind. If I can make it here, I can make it anywhere. And I knew right then, I mean instantly, that I wasn't supposed to try and find a better situation to awaken. I was supposed to stay right there in my everyday life and apply my forgiveness lessons here. And in fact, shortly after that, I was in a meeting with my peers. I was a director of a department. And my peers, there were 40 departments in my company, so there were 40 directors. And so I was in a meeting with all 40 of us, and I looked around, and I'd worked at this company for 9 years, so I knew all of these people. I looked around that table, and I thought, oh my gosh, there isn't a single person here that I like. No wonder this is my schoolhouse. No wonder I need to start right here. You know, I'm not at the maturity of thought in this environment. You know, if I run off from this environment thinking another environment is the one that's going to wake me up, I'm just missing all of the lessons that are presented to me right here, right now. Interesting, Kathy says, would I have any of them to dinner at my house? Well, in a way, Kathy, that was the next step I took. I didn't have them to dinner at my house. You know, this was the Boston area. We all could live, you know, hour and a half from each other and commute to the same place to work. But what I started doing, literally, one by one, knocking them off, one by one, I started inviting them to lunch. You know, every week I'd invite, you know, I'd take like a couple different days and I'd invite a different director to lunch. And I started going to lunch with these people and opening my mind and talking to them. And anything that I noticed in my mind that, you know, was judging them, I'd sit there, look them in the eyes over lunch and let it go. But when I say that where I am is my default, what I mean is I learned right then the practice happens here, not somewhere else. The practice happens here. Now, eventually, there was legitimate guidance to quit my job and move. But by the time that guidance came, let me tell you what was happening at work. By the time that guidance came, people were literally coming up to me in the hallway. And this is not a lie. This is the truth. And this was happening on a regular basis. And saying, wow, Regina, I don't know what you've done, but you have changed so much. I used to not like you, but now you're just one of my favorite people. This is what I was hearing. Or they were coming up to me and saying, wow, Regina, you've changed so much. What's going on with you? And they would come into my office and I'd close the door and I would tell them about, at that time it was A Course in Miracles and the practice of forgiveness. So in a way, I did learn my lessons there. And when the lessons there were learned, the time with that schoolhouse ended, and then I received the guidance to move to North Carolina, right, leave my job. And once I got to North Carolina, that's where I was going to be forever. I wasn't immediately looking for another place. So there were no like-minded people around me. And so some people would say, oh, I need to find some like-minded people. I did eventually meet Kathy there, by the way, Kathy who's right here, towards the end of this period. I did eventually meet Kathy and Karen, but that was towards the end. In the last 6 months, 9 months, I don't remember exactly, Kathy, maybe you know, before I moved. But the majority of the time that I was there, there were no like-minded people. And so, again, many people would say, I need to go to another place where there are like-minded people. But for me, this is my default. Where I am, this is where the lessons need to be applied. And it was there in that rather boring situation, a very tiny town, no like-minded people around, no friends. I had no friends at all. You know, I mean, Laurent came for a year and a half while he was there, but that was a huge challenge, you may remember, if you know that story. But, I mean, there in this very quiet, nothing-to-do place is where NTI was written. It's where Inner Ramana was written. And it's where I went through my 5-year purification period. And then, one day, having no intention to ever leave North Carolina, the guidance came to move to Pueblo. And now this is my default, right? And my relationship with Ron is my default. I'm not looking around for a better boyfriend, a like-minded boyfriend who will share in this with me. Ron is my default. If guidance comes, true guidance, well, then I can leave Ron. I even did it before with Laurent. Or if he leaves me, I can let that happen. But I'm not looking around for a better situation. So really, he says, maturity of thought and inquiry alone removes attachment to the body, and we can do that without changing anything. In fact, it's probably better that we do it right here where we are right now. It's kind of like the thought of the day that you guys are on if you're in gentle healing. You're on day one about how all things given are gifts, right, for our own awakening to peace and love, something like that. I'm on day 8, but I think that's something like that. Yeah, that means your situation right here, right now, with the people who are in your life, whatever job you have or retirement, if that's what you have, with, you know, with where you live, with your financial situation, I mean, you know, whatever, just tick it all off. Every single bit of that is where you need to be in order to let go of immature thinking and practice inquiry. So you don't need asceticism. So, actually, I've only read half of the second sentence, so let me read the rest of the sentence. Maturity of thought and inquiry alone removes attachment to the body, not the stations of life, such as student, etc. And I looked those up once, and I don't really remember what the details were, but basically it's a Hindu teaching that you go through these different phases before you awaken, the stations of life, one of which is the student. And it's typically the student that would become an ascetic, right? Become an ascetic and a disciple of a higher ascetic, of a more experienced ascetic. So he's saying maturity of thought and inquiry alone removes attachment to the body, not the stations of life such as student, etc. And I'm going to pause. Cheryl just put in today's thought. It's accept all things given. Right, which would be right where you are and right what you have, wouldn't it be? Accept all things given as a gift from our Holy Spirit for the purpose of peace and awakening to love, right? So whatever's here right now, that has been given. How do you know? Because it's here right now. So there you go. That's it. That is your gift. And it is here to help you awaken, to peace and love. So the next sentence. I'm going to go back. Maturity of thought and inquiry alone removes attachment to the body, not the stations of life, such as student, etc. For the attachment is in the mind, while the stations pertain to the body. And, you know, that's true in what I was talking about, too. You know, let's say that I decide Ron's not a like-minded boyfriend. I need a like-minded boyfriend, someone who's interested in talking about this stuff, and I dump Ron and find some spiritual guy. And that has nothing to do with changing my mind. That's changing the circumstances around the body, which means it's actually coming from the attachment to the body. Much better just to stay with what is given. Right? Yeah, it's outward focus. Much better just to stay with the current default situation and work on my own mind. Because that's where the actual attachment lives. I could go from boyfriend to boyfriend to boyfriend to boyfriend, always looking for the perfect one, and I'm not doing a thing to my mind. In fact, I'm reinforcing my belief that if I just got the right boyfriend, I could wake up. I just got the right guy. You know, that's not doing a thing. It's funny because I am going to be the guest minister at a local church this coming Sunday. And when they asked me, usually I spend Saturdays and Sundays with Ron. I'm sure you guys know. So when they asked me to be the minister, I asked Ron. I said, "Oh, Ron, they've asked me to be the minister at the Pueblo Divine Science Church next Sunday. Would you like to come with me?" And the face he made was like I asked him if he wanted to eat, you know, well, liver. Some of you guys may love liver, but I don't like liver. Just see me this awful face like, "Oh, my God, I can't think of anything worse." Yeah, liver and onions. Oh, my God. You know, so he's not at all interested in this stuff, right? Not at all. Not at all. But this is the gift that has been given. This is the gift that has been given. Now, well, maybe that lady would go to church with me, Kathy. So again, the attachment is in the mind. How can bodily stations remove attachment in the mind? Right? How can bodily stations, how can a new boyfriend or a new job or a new house remove attachments? The work needs to be done in the mind. It has nothing to do with where the body is or what's around the body. As maturity of thought and inquiry pertain to the mind, these alone can, by inquiry on the part of the same mind, remove the attachments which have crept into it. You know, it's interesting that he's talking about maturity of thought and inquiry. What this is really reminding me of is self-inquiry. Oops, I'm not good at typing and talking at the same time. Let me pause for a moment. Self-inquiry with a little s and self-inquiry with a capital S. Which is exactly what inner Ramana taught me, right? Ramana Maharshi isn't using those same words, but he seems to be teaching the same thing because he's talking about them as if they're two different things, maturity of thought and inquiry. The maturity of thought would be practicing the type of inquiry that gets you out of the wrong mind, helps you let go of false beliefs, helps you let go of those false roles, helps you let go of all of that thinking that belongs to the ego. Right? That's how you get to maturity of thought. You question the heck out of your mind until you've dropped every thought that isn't true. And then self-inquiry with the capital S, which is focusing on awareness until you realize yourself as that. So although Ramana Maharshi, the man, never used these terms that I'm aware of, self-inquiry with a small s, and self-inquiry with a capital S, that's actually what he's teaching right here in this answer. These are the two things you need to do. You need to get to maturity of thought through inquiry, and you need to realize the self through inquiry, right? How can bodily stations remove the attachment in the mind? As maturity of thought and inquiry pertain to the mind, these alone can, by inquiry on the part of the mind, remove the attachments which have crept into it. So he seems to be recommending self-inquiry and self-inquiry. Small s, self-inquiry, and capital S, self-inquiry. But, he says, as the disciple of asceticism is the means for attaining dispassion. Now, dispassion, by the way, is lack of interest in thoughts. That's dispassion. And you can even extend it if you want to lack of interest in outside circumstances, meaning not outward focused. But primarily dispassion is lack of interest in thought. So he says, as the disciple of asceticism is the means for attaining dispassion, and as dispassion is the means for inquiry, joining an order of ascetics may be regarded, in a way, as a means of inquiry through dispassion. It's funny that he throws in a way. You know, like, I don't know what's happening, but, you know, this is the scene I'm imagining. Hear the key word, imagining. That this young person is sitting in front of him that really is kind of excited, almost, and asking the question, is asceticism one of the essential requisites? Almost like, hey, you know, I want you to say yes so I can go home and tell my mom that Ramana Maharshi said I have to become an ascetic, and then I can go and be one. You know, I don't know if that's true or not, but almost like, this is the answer I want to hear. And so as Ramana Maharshi is saying that's not necessary, the person looks disappointed, like, oh, no. And so, you know, Ramana Maharshi, again, I'm making this up, but follow me with it. If you know anything about Ramana Maharshi never told people what to do. Ever. Ever, ever. So if he's got sitting in front of him a person who wants to become an ascetic and he can see that, then he's going to, in his own way, give them permission to become an ascetic, whether it's a necessary part of this process or not. He's not going to tell one that wants to go that way that they can't, you know. So, you know, I mean, that's what this answer reminds me of, and I don't know that for a fact, but again, listen to these, to the wording in the answer. As maturity of thought and inquiry pertain to the mind, these alone can, by inquiry on the part of the same mind, remove the attachments which have crept into it through thoughtlessness. Thoughtlessness here means non-awareness, not paying attention. But as the discipline of asceticism is the means for attaining dispassion, and as dispassion is the means for inquiry, joining an order of ascetics may be regarded, in a way, a means of inquiry through dispassion, right? But then listen to the very next sentence. Instead of wasting one's life by entering the order of ascetics before one is fit for it, it is better to live the householder's life, right? I mean, doesn't it sound like maybe he's talking to a face that wants to be an ascetic? And in his own gentle Ramana Maharshi way, he's trying to say that's not necessary. It's going to be a much harder life than you're imagining. Why don't you go ahead and get married? You know, do what people do, get a job, and practice inquiry. Right? Just love your ordinary life. It's actually going to be much easier on you. I mean, I don't know for sure that that's what's going on here, but it almost sounds like it. You know? But as the discipline of asceticism is the means for attaining dispassion, and as dispassion is the means for inquiry, joining an order of ascetics may be regarded, in a way, as a means of inquiry through dispassion. Instead of wasting one's life by entering the order of ascetics before one is fit for it, it is better to live the householder's life. See, some gentle advice there, but advice that can be rejected by the one listening if they wanted to hear that asceticism is the way. Okay? Instead of wasting one's life by entering the order of ascetics before one is fit for it, it is better to live the householder's life. In order to fix the mind in the self, with a capital S, in order to fix the mind in the self, which is its true nature, it is necessary to separate it from the family of fancies and doubts. Again, there's this idea that has occurred in my mind, probably is occurring in the mind of the person in front of him, whether it's a young man or an older guy that wants to get the heck away from his wife and kids. I don't know. But it has occurred to me that if I could just get away from my family, you know, Just get away from Ron and Jamie. And all of you all, I've confessed that to you, and all the responsibilities that come from being president, minister of awakening together. If I could just get away from everybody. then I could have the space I need to do this. And Ramana Maharshi is saying, you know, you don't really need to get away from your family. Not your physical family. It's that family of fancies and doubts in the mind that you need to get away from. And, you know, I've seen him say this in other places. He's not saying this here, but I've seen him say in other places, if you go to the cave, you know, those thoughts just go to the cave with you. And you don't have to go to the cave to use inquiry to get rid of those thoughts or to transcend that type of thinking. So in order to fix the mind in the self, which is its true nature, it is necessary to separate it from the family of fancies and doubts. That is, renounce the family and the mind. This is true asceticism. Right? That's a pretty clear message. We don't have to change anything, do we? Renounce the family and the mind. The family of fancies and doubts. So I have 3 minutes left, and I'm, you know, obviously not going to start a new question. So why don't we look at another Resta song? This one is called I Am Spirit.
I am spirit, I am divine. I am spirit, a light that shines through all creation, from sea to star, a lighted presence in every heart. I am spirit, I am spirit, spirit, I am spirit, I am spirit, I am spirit, 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 divine. I am spirit, I am whole. I am spirit, eternal soul, unborn and dying, many in one, with endless power of peace and love. I am spirit, I am spirit, spirit, I am spirit, I am spirit, spirit.
Thank you very much, y'all, and I'll be hanging around listening to Anne. Bye.